From KQED and the California Report, this is Capitol Notes, a weekly roundup of California politics from the state capitol in Sacramento.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Capitol Notes podcast for the week ending August 3rd. Thanks for joining us. As I usually say, we're in the studios across the street from the state capitol. Two of the people on this podcast are. I'm not. I'm in Philadelphia at the Association of Capitol Reporters and Editors. But as always, I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio and our good friend Anthony York from Capitol Weekly, who's in the studio. Hi, Anthony.
Hello.
This is so much fun. This is like a little conference call. And joining us this week, filling in for our pro bono political reporter, is my fellow KQED colleague Tamara Keith from our Sacramento Bureau. Hi, Tamara.
Hello.
Tamara is managing the important technical part of this podcast. I'm doing absolutely nothing other than talking on a phone from a hotel room.
And I'm the eye candy.
That's Anthony's job in most of these podcasts.
Most radio, yeah.
The levity, the humor, everything that it is. So we want to obviously talk about the big story of the week, I think mostly here, and I mean, I don't think, again, there's any way around the big policy and political story, and Tamara did some of the reporting at the end of the week, and I was unfortunate to draw the straw to have to sit there through the mess that was there with the state budget and the lack of an approval by the state Senate. But Anthony, why don't you start us off, fill us in? I mean, clearly we've got no budget, and we don't look like we're going to have a budget for some time.
Yeah, this just in, nothing happened. We had a vote earlier this week, as you know, you were there. The Senate was reconvened, and the early indications from Senator Perotta's office were that we were going to have a budget deal. Now, I don't know if that was just early posturing or what, but when it came down to it, Wednesday night, was it? It's all blurring together now.
Correct.
But Wednesday night, one Republican, Abel Maldonado from Santa Maria, who is facing an election next year, broke ranks with his caucus and voted with the Democrats and voted for the budget. But still, that 27th vote was elusive, and session was adjourned a couple hours later, still with no budget.
And let's set up the news here briefly, just the news overview, and then get in a little to the analysis. But clearly, right, we had 26 votes for a budget, one shy of the 27 needed, which means that Senator Maldonado, the Republican, was unable to find a friend, so to speak, though, as he said, it wasn't his job to find a second Republican vote. And the Senate not technically recessed until the end of August, but clearly there doesn't seem to be any indication that Senator Perotta, the leader of the Senate, is going to bring them back at this point. And then, Tamara, fill us in, if you could. The governor got up and talked about on Thursday his reaction to this whole thing.
Well, what the administration really wants us to know is that it wasn't just getting one more Republican. It wasn't that easy. They're calling it the rule of eight, this pact that the Senate Republicans have made, that eight of the 15, a majority, have to agree to it before two of them can vote for it. The Schwarzenegger administration wanted to make it very clear that they had a lot they were working against. Governor Schwarzenegger got up and essentially said, you know, I thought I gave them everything they wanted, and now I don't know what they want. And then he said, and I hope they know what they want, which I thought was a little catty from the governor.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the most public he has been about his frustration in this. And, you know, there's a lot of analysis going around here as we end this week with is this an Arnold Schwarzenegger problem at this point with not getting enough Republicans, not getting Republican support in his own party? Is this a legislative problem of Democrats and Republicans? Is this an internal Republican Party problem? Anthony, what do you think?
I think it's a little bit of all of the above. You know, we had talked last week about a possible solution, and this is where it appeared we were headed on Wednesday, where the Republicans and Democrats got together with the governor and agreed to a list of cuts that the governor could make with his line item veto authority that would allow Republicans to vote for a budget without reconvening the assembly. As it turned out, that wasn't enough. The Republicans have held firm and want some environmental reforms and some other things. In terms of what the problem is and whose problem this is, you know, this is the point in these sorts of standoffs where people begin to pay attention, where certain state services begin to get shut down, and I guess you don't have the problem of people not getting paid outside of legislative staff. But you know, this is I think it's, as we've said so many weeks before on this podcast, it's part of it is a respect issue that between the Republicans and the governor. Republicans feel that they've been run over time and time again. And I think that there are other things at play here, leadership components internally within the caucus. And I can't help but wonder if this is a little payback at the speaker, too, the speaker and Don Parada blowing up their hopes for a term limits deal, if you actually believe that voters in February, when they vote on a possible tweak in the state term limits law, will remember this budget standoff.
Well, we have to mention, certainly there has to be some mention, as Anthony, you just said, of this. There's a bit of a PR problem for Republicans at this point as the budget pain starts to hit home, or the lack of having a budget in place. There are countless news stories about some of the social services programs and community colleges and others who don't have money now because the state controller can't issue those checks. And what I found interesting on Wednesday night on the floor of the Senate was Senate Republicans trying to bring up what they were calling an emergency appropriation valued somewhere at around $10 billion that would allow some of these services to go on. Now, clearly, there's a policy objective to letting those services go on, but, trying to do some damage control, I think they tried to do, and Democrats would hear none of it and said, you know, they weren't going to consider that, and you've got to consider the budget in totality. And, Tamara, I know the governor talked a little bit yesterday at the news conference you attended on Thursday about this notion of how much he could do in the absence of a budget to pay bills.
Right, and it turns out there's not a ton that he can do for sort of the people that need it most. I mean, if there's a fire, it's a no-brainer. If there's a bridge collapse or some other disaster, obviously he can step in and bring money out. But apparently there is absolutely nothing he can do for the thousands of people that are in retirement homes or nursing homes and he can't really help the community colleges. It basically, his powers, as far as they can tell, and I'm sure they're looking for loopholes, but as far as he can tell, his powers extend basically to emergency. So in a lot of ways, his hands are tied.
I wonder what, let's talk about one of the political elements to this. What do you guys think? I mean, quite a speech by Abel Maldonado, the state senator from the Central Coast, the Republican, who doesn't get up on the floor of the Senate and speak much. Quite a speech he made on Wednesday night about why he was voting for this budget and breaking ranks from the other 15. I guess I'm calling them the gang of 14 now. But clearly breaking ranks, saying that this budget that the Assembly passed, that the governor supported, especially with all those line item vetoes, was good enough and was fiscally responsible. And it was quite a speech, especially when he talked about that there had been rumors of political payback if he voted for the budget.
And we've heard those today. Mike Spence, the head of the California Republican Assembly, a conservative organization, was threatening perhaps a primary challenge for Eva Maldonado. And now the pressure is being turned up on Jeff Denham, who's still seen as the most likely candidate for a 27th vote. I noticed this morning that the governor's press office sent to reporters, they sent out a copy of a Modesto Bee editorial, Modesto being Jeff Denham's hometown, and his hometown paper editorialized that Denham should vote for the budget. The governor's office, I think, has now become more engaged in this budget standoff. They tried to sort of stay above the fray for a month. But now, I mean, I think with the governor's press conference on Thursday and now making sure, in case you missed it, that that reporters had seen that Denham's hometown paper is urging him to vote for this budget, I think it reflects Schwarzenegger's increasing engagement to in this standoff and to try to get a solution.
Yeah, in a background briefing with the administration yesterday, a lot of us in the press corps kept asking, well, you know, how about this person? Couldn't you pick off this person? Isn't there anybody that's termed out? And they just kept coming back to over and over again, no, we're not employing a pickoff strategy. It may have looked like it at points when we kept meeting with people, but we're not employing a pickoff strategy. We've got to come up with something. But they didn't seem to have any, like, you know, light at the end of the tunnel on that.
And that sort of one of the issues here, I think the governor could probably point to this budget standoff as a case for redistricting reform. Senator Jim Batten, a conservative Republican from La Quinta, told me, I mean, we quoted him a couple of weeks ago as saying, hey, look, there are no consequences here. There are no consequences for these Republicans because they're in safe districts. So there's I mean, they can try to pressure Republicans, but who are you going to pressure them for? I mean, what effect is that pressure going to have?
Well, I was going to say, I wonder if we might see some modified version from the governor of his 2004 budget campaign in the coming days and weeks. You know, we'll remember in 2004 when he ran into a largely recalcitrant legislature about passing a budget, he went out on the campaign trail and started holding these town halls and these events, you know, saying that the legislature had to pass a budget. Of course, that's where he ran into his infamous Gurleyman comment down in Southern California. But, he didn't do that in the 2 years afterwards. He chose a different way of dealing with budgets. But, you know, we've got a problem, so to speak, here. And I'm wondering, you know, does he go back out on the campaign trail in some modified way? I mean, wouldn't it be something if he went to Jeff Denham's district or State Senator Bob Dutton, somebody else who was rumored that might vote for the budget, a Republican, or somewhere else, you know, or you know, what does he do to move this dynamic forward, if anything?
Well, again, how popular is the governor in those Republican districts? I think that's an open question. I mean, there are a lot of people who will argue, hey, he's still the governor, he's still Arnold Schwarzenegger, he can still apply some pressure. But there was a new poll out this week, something that was publicized on the conservative site, the Flash Report, showing that the governor's popularity among Republicans is at an all-time low. So, again, it brings into question just how many leverage points the governor has and how much pressure he could successfully apply.
And yet at the same time, Anthony, wasn't there – there's also – I mean, you know, in the context, I guess, of not dueling polls, but you know, certainly polls with different opinions kind of coming out, of summations coming out – the recent Public Policy Institute of California's poll about environmental issues showing that things that the governor had pushed for that were not popular with legislative Republicans were popular with rank-and-file Republicans. I mean, might he have – I mean, it's hard to know how rank-and-file Republicans feel until you go out and talk to them, but –
I think that in terms of the budget, at least, for this governor, it's – as Don Parada said, it's a Republican problem. I don't know how much he wants to go out and highlight his differences with his own party. Someone yesterday actually asked him, you know, with all your trouble, what about following the Bloomberg course and going independent? And he was like, what, you know, what trouble? I think despite coming out and sort of slamming his own members of his party, at the same time, I think he doesn't. I think he might not be ready to you know, call his own party Gurleyman.
Well, let's look forward, if we can, briefly in the always dangerous crystal ball of trying to figure out what happens next. But let's assume, for the sake of argument for a moment, that nothing happens until the assembly comes back at the end of August.
Right.
Different dynamic for budget negotiations then, is there not?
I mean, I know Tamara,
that some of the administration folks talked about, they're worried that everything comes back on the table then under negotiation.
Absolutely. That when the assembly is back, things that they thought were closed issues, done deals, that's all back on the table if the assembly can take it up again. If it doesn't have to be in the form it is now. Ooh, I feel like we'll be back to July 1st, except it'll be September 1st.
Right. I mean, remember, the budget passed out of the assembly with the agreement that on a tax cut package that they thought they were going to be able to get through the Senate. They tried to dump on the Senate. That tax cut package has long since been declared dead. And because of that, there might be some members of the assembly who want to reopen negotiations if they get a chance. So, you know, if we go to August 20th, which it appears – as if we're headed to, I'm just judging from the body language and the comments of Senator Parada and others this week, you know, who knows what's going to happen?
Well, and I was going to say, if that's the case, and if you do go back into a back and forth with the assembly, I mean, you've got to think all bets are off about breaking the record for the longest budget impasse in California state history. I mean, the longest one was 2002 when Gray Davis signed the budget after Labor Day. I think it was September 5th, I think. Someone will call me and tell me if I'm wrong, I'm sure. One of our seven listeners. We have more than seven, we think. But,
15.
I mean, you know, all bets have got to be off, are they not?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, but, you know, you've got to come back to this question. What is the standoff about? You know, I mean, it's $700 million, which I don't mean to belittle $700 million, but in the context of a $120 billion budget, Is that really what's holding this up?
Oh, no. That's definitely, they already have that, you know, in terms of the Senate Republicans. They won that. That they've got their list. They say they trust the governor to make those cuts, and they want more. They introduced a package that didn't get debated or voted on or anything like that, that actually cut even more, an additional $140 million, I think Ackerman said. I've had a hard time sort of pinning down what it is that they want, but it's not
as
just,
has everyone.
Right. Yeah, but it's not just the $700 million because they got that.
Well, and you know, this is something that we've been following in Capital Weekly. Increasingly, the budget is the one time of year where people have to pay attention to Republicans. And so you're seeing their list, Republican bills get introduced and killed by Democratic majorities in both houses. And you see this in a lot of the deals, trailer bills that we've written about in Capital Weekly. But I think that's part of what's going on here with this discussion over the over CEQA, the Environmental Quality.
The California Environmental Quality Act.
Reform that a lot of Republicans are talking about. The budget becomes the one place where Republicans have leverage to get any kind of policy done, whether or not it has anything to do with the budget. And I think that that now is my best guess for what's holding this up. I mean, according to what Senator Ackerman was saying this week, I don't know if there are other policy issues out there that they've been discussing.
There's a fun one, which is something to do with bond implementation. And apparently it's still outstanding that the Republicans think L.A. is getting too much money for traffic light synchronization.
Oh, the $150 million
yes.
that was written into the bond.
Yes, right. For traffic light synchronization in Los Angeles.
And let's just all be honest about this. No one mentioned traffic light synchronization last week.
But Bob Hertzberg ran for mayor on it. So, you know.
But the point being is that, you know, with all due respect to the folks either who work for or who are a member of what I'm going to call the Gang of 14. I like that, by the way. I'm sticking with it. This is not something that you heard anybody talking about before. We've talked about bond implementation issues, sure, but I mean, it seems you know, as every day goes on, there's something else that they are trying to hang this on to show that it's substantive.
Well, that's your opinion. You may well think that. I couldn't possibly comment.
Well. Anthony, you're speechless for a change.
No. It's a never mind. House of Cards. It's a Brit. Never mind.
Well,
you can
Google it. So
Google.
To wrap this up, I will. I'm in a hotel room. I got time. So as we wrap this up, guys, is there anything based as the way the week ended on the budget impasse that anyone should be looking for to try to figure out what happens next, or is it really just a who knows?
Watch the governor's travel schedule, as you said, to see if he camps out in Merced, I think.
That would be some party, let me tell you.
To get Arnold Schwarzenegger to go to Merced in August, I think, you know, the resentment alone, I think, would be sufficient and to qualify as entertainment for us.
Resentment of the Capitol press corps as we had to schlep around the state, but...
And the governor, I'm sure.
And our one listener in Merced might be writing in soon.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're going to get a Merced blowback here, I've got a feeling. Well, let's transition quickly here to talk about, I mean, it's not an impact probably, and Anthony, you may tell me then that I'm wrong on that. It's not necessarily an impact in this year's budget impasse, but clearly you've got another dynamic in the legislature of not only the leadership in the legislature in both houses this year, but you've got a lot of people angling to be the next leaders of the Assembly and the Senate, and you were following that this week in Capital Weekly.
Right, that's because July 31st was the last date to report fundraising totals for the first half of the year. Look, if this term limits tweak doesn't pass in February, the day after that election, there's going to be a full blown race for new leaders in both houses, we got some clues. I think fundraising is certainly a key part of that job. To be an effective leader, you have to be an effective fundraiser, and we saw an example or a sampling of some of the fundraising prowess for some of the members. And not surprisingly, the people who came out on top are the people who are often mentioned as potential successors, both to Senator Don Parada and to Speaker Fabian Nunez.
And so who would some of those be? I mean, let's piece it apart. Let's go to the Assembly first and talk about, I don't know, who might be the next Speaker of the Assembly if term limits changes don't pass at the ballot box.
Well, the four top fundraisers, I think, are all candidates for Speaker. These are the four top fundraisers, excluding the Speaker himself. You have Alberto Tirico, chairman of the Assembly Governmental Organization Committee, the SIN Committee that deals with all the gaming issues and alcohol and tobacco. He's from
Democrat
Newark.
From Norwalk, right?
Not Norwalk. He's from the East Bay, from Newark, I believe.
Oh, Newark.
In the East Bay.
Norwalk, Newark.
Norwalk is Los Angeles County. Anyway.
My apologies, folks in Newark.
Yeah, I guess
or Norwalk.
I guess you didn't bring your red book to Philly.
Let's see, Kevin DeLeon, a good friend of the Speaker's from the neighboring district from Los Angeles.
Childhood friend of the Speaker's.
Absolutely. And certainly has the same fundraiser and some of the same fundraising contacts. Karen Bass, a Democrat, the majority leader from Culver City, another Democrat like De Leon with strong labor ties, and Hector De La Torre, a Democrat from Southgate, who is chair of the Assembly Rules Committee and another potential candidate for Speaker.
And they've all done some pretty substantive fundraising, or who's ahead in that group?
I believe Tirico is technically ahead. He has $450,000 on hand. De Leon has about the same amount. Karen Bass has over $300,000, and De La Torre has in the neighborhood of $260,000, $270,000.
Aren't there some others in that category as well? I noticed you mentioned in your piece on Capital Weekly, plug, go to capitalweekly.net. There you are, Anthony.
Hey, thank you. Capital with an O. Thank you very much.
But what about, there's some others that are sometimes talked about leadership in the Assembly. Assemblywoman Fiona Ma, a Democrat from San Francisco.
Right, who's raised a lot of money. She also spent a lot of money. She spent $150,000 in the first 6 months, a lot of that to retire debt from her campaign against Janet Riley in 2006. But certainly Democrats from San Francisco have traditionally been excellent fundraisers, and Fiona Ma is no exception.
And then I know in the Senate, is it largely a two-man race to possibly succeed Senate Pro Tem Don Parada?
That's the conventional wisdom, that it's a race between Daryl Steinberg, senator from Sacramento, and Alex Padilla, a senator from Los Angeles. But that they're not necessarily the top fundraisers. Interestingly, I believe the top fundraiser, in terms of cash on hand we're talking, is Leland Yee, a Democrat from San Francisco, and another Democrat who I don't think many people would say is a candidate for pro tem, but she still has a lot of money in the bank, is Gloria Negrete McLeod, who's from the Chino area, Democrat. Both Yee and Negrete McLeod are unofficial members of the so-called Mod Squad, more moderate Democrats, and some of those moderate votes I think have helped their fundraising tremendously. They've been able to raise money from interests that a non-traditional Democratic that are not traditional Democratic donors, a lot of businesses, tobacco companies, other companies that don't give to other Democrats necessarily have given to Negrete McLeod and Yee and other moderates.
I wonder, should we do we is it you know, it's there are multiple theories about, is it too early to be talking about these things now, or actually, I guess it's not, given that we've got to see where the term limits initiative goes in February. But you know, just in terms of how much time they have to raise money, and then also the connection between raising the money and the ability to get votes to become the Assembly Speaker or the Senate Pro Tem.
I think it is a big part of the caucus's calculus. Can I say that? Anyway, I should
try it again.
Probably, no, I don't think 10 times fast. But I do think that people in both parties do consider that, when they're choosing their next leader. I'm hard-pressed to find a leader that is not a good fundraiser. You know, John Burton was able to defeat Pat Johnston in his race for pro tem back in 97, and the deciding vote was cast by Ralph Dills. And Ralph Dills, the main criterion for him to cast the vote was fundraising, and Burton was an expert fundraiser. It's like we say in the piece, it's not the only measure of a leader, but it's an important one. As to the question of whether or not it's too early, I will only judge by the off-the-record conversations I had with almost every member mentioned in that piece who wanted to make sure that, you know, once they heard I was writing it, wanted to make sure that their voice was at least unofficially heard, makes me think that, no, it's not too early and that people are already thinking about this.
A lot of people thinking out the chess move, so to speak, of what will happen next and how they position themselves the right way.
Yeah, although I don't know. I mean, I think with the fundraising, some of it's chess and some of it's just brute force, you know, trying to show, you know, it's kind of a show of strength to show how much money you have. Although it also puts a target on your back. Remember, the speaker, the speaker's got his term limits initiative in February, and as long as he's the leader, I think he has the right to call on some of these members with a lot of money in the bank and ask for some help for that initiative or for whatever else the speaker may be pushing. And I think that, you know, it's a balance where all these potential successors to Nunez and Parada are part of their leadership teams.
And I was going to say it's a fascinating dynamic you've got to think over the next weeks and months as people watch the polling on the term limits initiative. And whether or not, you know, if, let's say, for sake of argument, the term limits initiative looks like it's going to go down, at what point might somebody start jumping out to make more overt actions towards a leadership position, not necessarily waiting for the vote to come in on February 5th?
Right, and that's a calculation that someone like Kevin DeLeon will have to take special care, because he, on the one hand, his good friend is the speaker, but not everybody's going to wait for the speaker on this. And we've seen this stuff ruin friendships in the past. Bob Hertzberg and Antonio Villaraigosa, both former speakers of the assembly, had a huge falling out over the timing of a potential transition and basically destroyed their friendship. So, you know, this will be interesting to watch on a bunch of levels in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, I was going to say there are going to be a lot of there's the potential, I should say, to have a lot of bruised feelings by the time fall comes around in state politics, from a budget impasse that could keep going to, you know, who knows what will happen on issues like health care and redistricting, and then you've got these kind of dynamics. It's going to be an odd one, I suppose.
Tying it all together, nicely done, John.
It's, you know, I'm looking for a way to leave people with some joy, some hope, some
some warm fuzzies.
Yeah, some warm fuzzies.
Well, why don't you sing to us, John?
This is that point also where Tamara thanks her lucky stars that she doesn't have to cover this every day.
Absolutely.
She can focus on fish in the Delta.
Yeah, I can go back to worrying about smelt and whatnot.
Well, guys, is there anything I should bring you from Philadelphia? You want a little Liberty Bell tokens or some cream cheese or
some Yingling?
Some Yingling lager.
Yeah. Some cheese whiz.
Well, you know, I've got to go down to get the Philly cheesesteak. You know, I haven't done that yet, so.
I highly recommend the Cheese Whiz. It just adds a whole new depth to the flavor of the cheesesteak, I've got to say.
If there are any fans of Cheese Whiz out there and you've got a place to recommend before I leave on Sunday, drop me an email. Well, I guess that'll do it for this edition of the Capital Notes podcast, unless you guys in Sacramento have some other pithy things to say. Anthony, that's usually you.
I'm tapped.
You're tapped. And I think that's pretty much the way we leave it. We're tapped. For Anthony York and Tamara Keith, I'm John Myers from KQED and the California Report. We'll see you next time.